You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It is lovely to see all of you here on an unexpectedly pleasant Washington summer day. I'm Tamara Wittes. I'm a director of the Center for Middle East Policy here at Brookings and delighted to convene today's event along with my colleagues in governance studies here at Brookings. And we're here to talk about Orlando, the Orlando shootings, the Middle East, and the U.S. election. And I think we've seen a lot of discussion, a lot of debate, a lot of rhetoric already in the presidential campaign and the broader electoral climate this year about the Middle East, about Islam, about a range of policy topics related to the Middle East. But I think one question we haven't really focused on yet is how much the Middle East actually matters to the American public and in what way. We're very grateful to Shibley Talhami, our distinguished colleague, non-resident fellow at Brookings, and also the Sadat Chair at the University of Maryland, for this regular series of public opinion polls he does looking at the American public and their attitudes toward the Middle East and toward Islam. And it's particularly timely and important, this set of data, as Shibley will explain. Through the course of his polling, he identified some interesting trends related to American attitudes toward Islam. As our rhetoric has scaled up on this issue, how have public attitudes changed? And if any of you saw his piece in Politico this morning, you'll see that they've changed in some unexpected ways, some ways that might even be heartening to us after a week in which our society has felt in some ways more divided than ever. So I'm not going to take any more of your time here because Shibley has a lot of great information to share with you. I'm going to turn it over to him. He will give a PowerPoint presentation. Please follow along. Tweet, if you like, some of the data with our hashtag After Orlando. And then when Shibley's done with his presentation, we will invite him up on the stage together with Bill Galston, the Ezra Zilka Chair in Governance Studies here at Brookings, and we'll have a conversation between ourselves and then with all of you. Shibley, thanks so much.
Well, thanks a lot, Tamara. It's always a great pleasure for me to do this. And those of you have attended some of these presentations before with the new poll data know that we try to get this as in a timely fashion. So we rush right to get it out. And so before I tell you a little bit more about this poll, let me thank a few people who helped us get this out. This was just done a couple of weeks ago, and we were able to analyze and get it out very quickly, particularly the second one. So I want to first start with thanking my colleagues at the Program for Public Consultation, Steve Cull, Evan Lewis, Clay Ramsey. They've always been extremely helpful in with the data and the questions and. Also, Nielsen Scarborough, with whom we do the polling, they were terrific because I went to them after Orlando and said, can we do a quick poll? And they got a fantastic poll out for us in a timely fashion. Neil Schwartz is here, Jordan Evangelista, Scott Willith, who also helped with this. I also want to thank particularly my assistant, Brittany Kaiser, who's here, who's been fantastic in working weekends to try to get this data out. Brookings staff has been fabulous. I want to mention particularly Ann Peckham, Rachel Slattery, a lot of other people who helped put this together. So I'm grateful for them because that's the way, we can get this out very quickly. So now I want to just tell you a little bit more about what I'm going to present today. I'm presenting the results of two polls, not one poll. Now, normally I track public opinion, American public opinion on the Middle East on a regular basis. And I did one last November on issues related to Islam and Muslims, attitude toward the Arab-Israeli issue, ranking of priorities in the Middle East, a variety of other things that we released here in November. I aim to do another one in May, which I did the end of May, to be released now. Actually, this was the week we wanted to be releasing it, just before the conventions. And we had that data, and it was an interesting data. And then, of course, we had the horror of Orlando. And since the issues that I was, of course, tracking related to events like Orlando, and you'd expect that it'd be affected by it, so I thought before I would release it, I wanted to do another poll right after Orlando, within 2 weeks. And we were able to get another poll. So we have really comparison of three points of data beginning November, all with Nielsen Scarborough, with good size samples. So what I'm presenting today are the two polls, the one from May 2016 and the one from June 2016, before and after Orlando on a variety of issues. You're welcome to go to the website, both at Brookings or the Sadat website at the University of Maryland for methodology. This is a national sample in both cases of a probability panel that Nielsen Scarborough has. In the first, the May one, it was a sample of 855 national sample plus 735 oversample of millennials. The error margin is roughly 3.4%. And the June sample was actually a little larger. It was 1312 national sample with margin of error of 2.7%. And you could look at that. So let me start with one main cluster, which is attitudes toward Islam and Muslims, something I have been tracking. And those of you who have attended these events before last December, we did one in which we had identified attitudes toward Islam and Muslims. And in fact, I wrote an article for it in that was highly circulated related to shifts in American public opinion on this issue. So I wanted to repeat those questions again, and basically I have three questions. First question is, what is your attitude about each of the following, the Muslim people? I say that because we have discovered that the American public differentiates between quote, Muslim people, unquote, Muslim religion, that they don't identify the two exactly in the same way, and they have differing attitudes. They tend to have a more favorable attitude of the Muslim people and a less favorable attitude of the Muslim religion. This has been, and I've written about this before, we can discuss that. So we break it down. So the Muslim people, I want to show you the three points. November 25, May 2016, and June 2016. Look at what we find. We have exactly the opposite of what some people are expecting. Despite the rhetoric of our campaign that has been inflammatory toward Islam and Muslims, and despite the horror of terrorism and violence on our soil perpetrated in the name of Islam, what has happened since November is actually American public attitudes toward Islam and Muslims have progressively improved. And I want you to look at this because in just the Muslim people, it was 53% favorable in November. It was 58% favorable in May. And right after Orlando was 62% favorable. That is the general trend. Now, if you break it down by party, that's where some of the story is, because you can see that Republicans didn't change at all, basically within the margin of error. The attitudes on Muslim people remained the same, 41%, 43%, 42% favorable up at the top. So they didn't change. The change happened among Democrats and independents. So you can see that Democrats moved from 67% to 72% to 79%, and the same thing in independents, 43 to 53 to 60%. Independents, of course, are a small size at this point of the election, so most of the changes happened really within the Democratic Party, and not much change happening on the Republican Party. Now, the same thing happens with regard, let me just see here, I thought I had some another slide, but let me, so the Muslim people, again, look at the political candidates. So I break it down by supporters of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Essentially, those people who say they would vote for those candidates if elections were held today. And if you look at the percentages, you could tell the story. Just from May to June, this is the change from May to June, just basically 1 month before and after Orlando. So if you look at Hillary Clinton supporters, you could see the favorable actually moved up. For Donald Trump, you could see the unfavorable slightly moved up. It's really within the margin of error, remaining the same. But you could see a huge difference between the two. What is your opinion of the Muslim religion? Again, look at this. It's remarkable. It's exactly the same trend. 37% favorable in November to 42% in May to 44% in June. It's still under 50%. Keep that in mind. So opinions of Islam remain low in the American public, but they've improved substantially, 7 percentage points, since November at a period during which we've had heated rhetoric on Islam and Muslims, as well as violence in San Bernardino and Orlando perpetrated in the name of Islam. Again, here's the same trend. Look at the breakdown by party. Nothing happens among Republicans. They stay very negative, very unfavorable view of the Islamic religion. Really, three quarters of Republicans stay that way. They increase a little bit, actually, from November, but still really within the margin of error. Democrats, you look at the numbers, very different. Not that they're positive, but they're much more positive, much more favorable. Actually, they start off with 51% favorable among Democrats of the Muslim religion. They end up in June was 64% favorable of the Muslim religion. And if you, again, break it down by candidate, you could see the difference. Among Hillary Clinton supporters in June, 66% favorable. Among Donald Trump, 84% unfavorable. So it's really huge polarization on this issue. One final question. Related to this cluster of attitudes toward Islam and Muslims, we have a question, but we'll call it the clash of civilization question, where we ask them, which one of those two options, statements are closer to your view? Islamic and Western religious and social traditions are incompatible with each other. Most people in the West and the Islamic world have similar needs and wants, so it is possible to find common ground. And again, look at the bottom number of people who think there is common ground. It's possible to find common ground. That percentage goes from 57% in November to 61% in May to 64% in June. The same exact trend. And again, break it down by party, and you find exactly the same pattern. Republicans really don't move. Look at that at the top. You know, the people who say it's incompatible, it's as close as it can be in three polls, 56%, 55%, 55%. It just stays the same. And then you look at the Democrats and Republicans, the Democrats and independents, they move in a different direction. Obviously, the same holds when you look at the candidates, if you look at the percentage of people who say the two are compatible at the bottom, the second category, you can see that even Hillary Clinton's supporters moved from 78% to 85% saying they're more compatible, whereas Trump supporters went slightly in the other direction, but obviously a small shift, 4 percentage points, not particularly significant, but still is moving in another direction. So I think the bottom line on this is you could see, first of all, that we have a highly polarized American public on this issue. And overall, the trend obviously is more favorable than one might have expected, and really remarkably so in a short span of 7 months of the political campaign. Now, I want to probe Orlando specifically, and that might also give us some insight as to why it didn't have as much as a negative effect as one might have expected. And so we asked a number of questions about Orlando specifically. First of all, it was a factual question. I always like to see how much the public knows. So one question we asked was, based on what you have heard, is it your impression that the Orlando shooter, Omar Mateen, was an American citizen born in the United States, an American citizen who immigrated to the United States, a foreigner who has been living in the United States, a foreigner who came to the United States recently? So just those four options that were initially talked about in the debate. Well, most Americans get it right. 66% get it right. I mean, that's good, actually. You know, that tells you that people are actually paying a lot of attention, because but at the same time, you can see that, roughly a third of the, population, a quarter of the population anyway. No, it's actually more, a third of the population is not getting it right. So the discourse is having an impact, and we know that there have been, narratives to the contrary. Again, if you look at it by Democrat, Republican, and Independent, here actually on the facts, there isn't as much of a difference as you might be inclined to accept. I mean, look at the people who get it right. It's roughly broken down pretty much 65% of Republicans, 68% of Democrats, 64% of Independents. So that doesn't have much of an impact. Based on what you have heard, please rank your impression of each of the following factors that may have contributed to the Orlando shooter's behavior. So here, I want you to know that what we did is we gave them several factors that have been talked about in the discourse, and we asked them initially to rank them from 0 to 10 on a scale. And here's what we got. And these are, the mean of each answer. So the number one, the most, went to the hate for the LGBT community. And number two was militant Islamist ideology. Number three, mental illness, self-hate, and then feeling rejected as a Muslim in America didn't get a lot. And then we asked them another question. Now that they've looked at each one of these separately, which one do they assess is the most important in their own mind to choose one only of the following factors? And here's what we get. We got 33% say militant Islamist ideology, 21% say mental illness, 19% say self-hate, 16% say hate for the LGBT community. So what's interesting here is, of course, the number one answer is militant Islamist ideology, but note that only one-third of the American public think that's the most important factor. And that tells a story about why they're not making a big connection between the event and those people who are making that connection. They're probably answering in the way that they've answered on, unfavorably of Islam and Muslims. But most Americans don't think this is the most important factor. That's really interesting, I think, and that tells you a story about Orlando. Now, based on your impression, was the Orlando shooter acting under the direction of ISIS, independently but inspired by ISIS, or independently for reasons unrelated to ISIS but claiming links to ISIS for boasting, as his father had claimed, for example? And so here again, 57% say he was inspired by ISIS. Obviously, most people get it right. He wasn't working. There was no evidence that he was under the direction of ISIS. But it's also interesting that, one-third think that he wasn't even inspired by ISIS. He was just using it for self-posting. So it's much more nuanced view of the motives than one might expect. And when you break it down, here you find, more of a partisan divide where, 71% of Republicans think he was inspired by ISIS ideology, whereas 51% of Democrats actually think he was not inspired by ISIS ideology. They think he was basically, using it to boast. So how much do you approve or disapprove of the following leaders' reactions to the Orlando shootings? This, too, is an important one because obviously we know that the president spoke out immediately after the presumed Republican and Democratic candidates spoke right after, and the public was highly focused on this, so most people were aware of what they said. That was a center of story in our debate. So here's the view. 52% thought approved of the president's reaction, 50% approved of Hillary Clinton's reaction, only 40% approved of Donald Trump's reaction. So obviously the narrative war here was one more but the Democratic side and the Republican side. How would you rate the effectiveness of the following actions in reducing the chance of an Orlando-like shooting? Please rate on a scale of 0 to 10. And so we gave them all sorts of options that were talked about in the discourse about what might reduce the chance of another Orlando-like attack, and here's what we got. The number one answer is banning the sale of any weapons to people on terrorist and criminal watch lists. The second is better security at public venues. The third is fighting ISIS and similar groups abroad more effectively. Next is banning the sale of assault rifles. And then the last one was closely monitoring mosque and Muslim American groups. That got the least support among the American public. And then when we asked them directly, now that you've looked at each one of these separately, now which two, I believe two or one did we say here, I think which one do you think is most important? Which one do you think is most important? And so they rank them in the following way when you ask them directly about these. 25% say banning the sale of weapons to people on terrorist criminal lists. 23% say banning assault rifles and rapid bursts rapid bursts of bullets. 17% say better security at public venues, and only 10% say monitoring mosques and Muslim American groups. So again, they're not linking this so much to the issue of Islam and Muslims as such. They in their own mind. I want to move very rapidly through two other issues. One is how Americans rank the Middle East in global priorities, because we talk about the Middle East as if it's the end of the world, and obviously there are so many issues on the agenda, and want to have a sense of where the public ranks the Middle East in global priority. And then I'm going to turn very rapidly to the Arab-Israeli issue, what has changed and what hasn't, before we have a discussion. So let me start here. On a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is very important and 1 is not important, how important are the following issues in American global priorities? Again, this is a ranking of each one. So we asked them to rank the war on ISIS, U.S. immigration policy, war on Al-Qaeda, trade deficit, the rise of China, Iran, North Korea, Russia, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Egypt-Saudi Arabia, the civil war in Libya, a civil war in Yemen. So we had all sorts of issues that we asked them to rank. And what you notice here is that when you ask them to rank them from 1 to 10, the number one is, of course, the war on ISIS, which is what we've had, and it's not surprising particularly at this time. But it followed by U.S. immigration policy. The war on Al-Qaeda is also up there. We decided to split them to see if the public separates them. And then the trade deficit, then China, then Iran, Korea. But you can see that the Middle East is not really that high up on that list. And then we asked them specifically, choose now two of these as the most important. So Here's what we have. When they choose two on their own of all of these priorities after they have looked at them individually, ISIS gets 61%. Remember, these will add up to roughly 200% because they're choosing two. So ISIS gets 61%, top issue, followed by immigration policy, followed by trade deficit, and then followed by a war on Al-Qaeda, North Korea. But notice how even Iran is only getting 7%. The war on Libya and Yemen are getting 1%. The relation with Egypt to Saudi Arabia is very low. And even the Arab-Israeli issue is really about the equal of the Iran issue on this list of priorities. Now, I want to turn to one final question in this cluster of worldviews. Now, I want to just a quick preface. I generally ask a question that I try to get at the framework that people use in their own minds when they give an answer to. I know that this changes. So I ask a question, please name a national and world leader you admire most. I don't tell them what kind of leader. It's an open-ended question. They're right, and poor Brittany, she had to, obviously dozens of names, and we have to tabulate each one, and we had 1,312, and then we have to sort it out and figure out which one. That's the thing about open-ended questions, but of course you get a lot of value out of them as well. And so we asked that in November. I'm going to tell you a little bit about later on what we found in November. But we asked it again this time, and I want you to see this because the Middle East pops up inevitably here as well. So, among Republicans, the number one answer is Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. By the way, he was also number one in November among Republicans, but he was roughly tied with Ronald Reagan. Now he's ahead of Ronald Reagan. So maybe Bill will explain this to us when we sit down in the conversation. And then you could see, Ronald Reagan, obviously, even Barack Obama is popular among some Republicans. Pretty interesting. Among Democrats, it's no competition. It's really Barack Obama. And then it's the Pope, and then it's Justin Trudeau. And among independents, it's pretty close. No one really gets a lot. 9% for Obama, 6% for Merkel, and 6% for Putin. So, and by the way, Putin ranks pretty high up there among Republicans. I think he may be number four among Republicans as well. But again, these are small percentages in open-ended questions. But still, it tells you something. In your opinion, which one of the following two factors do you think has been most important in the emergence and growth of ISIS? So this is another question about, the reason I asked this question is lost in the previous poll. I had asked a question whether they thought the Iraq war, in a poll I did on refugees, I asked a question whether they thought the Iraq war had something to do with the creation of the Syrian refugee crisis. And I had actually most Americans say, at least some, in fact, a majority said a lot to do with it. But there was no blame. Who's to blame for the Iraq war? That was a separate question. And so here I actually wanted to ask a question about the link between the Iraq war and the rise of ISIS. And so I only gave them two options that are relevant for our debates because of the way the campaigns are going. Going to war with Iraq in 2003 or withdrawing most U.S. troops in 2011. And because those are the two that are talked about, and they're part of the narratives. You have people like Senator McCain who say it's the second. You have Democrats who say it's the first. And you have people like Trump who say it's both. This is all over the map, actually. And so what we have here is 55% of the public says it's going to war with Iraq versus 41 who say it's withdrawing the troops from Iraq. And, of course, when you break it down by party, you're going to get 74% Democrats say it's the former and 61% of Republicans say it's the latter. And the independents are closer on this one to the Democrats than they are to the Republicans. Now, I want very quickly to dash through questions about the Arab-Israeli conflict. Now, I invite you, I'm not going to go through every single one in detail. I invite you to look at them online. We've posted them. They're all posted now, actually, both at the Brookings website, at the University of Maryland website. You're welcome to look at them. But I want to just give you a couple of broad broad findings and then just run through them very quickly. One is that there really isn't a huge overall shift in, really in the past three polls that I did on this issue. This issue was not repeated in the June poll. It was done in May, in the May 2016 poll, in the November 2015 poll, and also a year earlier, where American attitudes on most of the issues that I probe here have changed only a little and mostly within the margin of error. No huge shifts. What has happened is more and more polarization by party, where Republicans have increasingly grown more and more supportive of Israeli policies, and Democrats have grown more and more uneasy about Israeli policies. And this really is the finding here, but I'm just going to go through very quickly a couple of them. One about the Palestinian two-state solution versus one-state solution. There really isn't much of a shift from November to May. Look at that. I mean, it's pretty much the same. You know, a two-state solution, about 35 in November, 34 now, 31 to 33 for one-state solution. Slight increase in the one-state, but within the margin of error. So it's really, I would call that just a tie. And by party, you have a little more polarization. Actually, even when you compare it in the two polls, you do have a party effect for sure. And younger people, millennials, and we have a pretty large sample of millennials here, by the way. We could talk about millennials with confidence. We have a sample of over 735, actually 800 and some plus millennials in this sample altogether. The margin of error here is only 3.3% actually for the millennials. And so the millennials tend to support one state more than the rest of the population. The same could be seen on a host of questions, but I want to go quickly through this question, which is if the two-state solution is no longer possible, do you favor the Jewishness of Israel more than its democracy or Israel's democracy more than its Jewishness? And by the way, we spell it out. We spell it out, so this is just a short for what it means. And again, you see that Americans, by and large, haven't changed much, a little bit, you know, within the margin of error change. But I could tell you that across, when you look at it by party, more Democrats now support democracy even more than Jewishness, and slight decline in Republican support, but still a majority. I mean, you look at it, it's a majority across the board, but there's not much change. And that even holds, by the way, certainly if you look at by age 18 to 34, the black line, more people choose Israel's democracy over its Jewishness, 78%. Even among Trump supporters, if you look at that, a majority support Israel's democracy over its Jewishness by a smaller margin, 52% to 42%, versus the supporters of Hillary Sanders Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, who are almost identical. And by the way, is an interesting thing I want to say very quickly, which is that there are no huge differences between the supporters of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders on almost any of these issues. There are only two issues where there's slight difference. I'll talk about one of them in a minute, but you could see here there isn't, and I think you'll see it across the board. The same thing with the leaning toward Israel. Do they want the U.S. to lean toward Israel or to lean toward neither side or to lean toward the Palestinians? We've always had roughly two-thirds who say lean toward neither side. You could see a slight decline here, 66% to 33%, but almost all of it comes out of the Republican side, where their number of support for Israel increased. You can actually look at it, where now 52% of the Republicans want to take Israel's side. It was less than 50% last time. And the Democrats leaning toward neither side actually increased. So again, increased polarization is the real story here, not so much any particular shift. The same thing, you know, when you look at Sanders and Clinton supporters, if you look at this question, you know, they're identical. There's very little difference. The same thing with the support for a Palestinian state. I want to say here that in terms of those people who support the U.S. taking action at the U.N. on behalf of Palestinian state, 27% said they would favor supporting that at the U.N. in November. The exact number here in May. The difference is that now 35% say they would vote against it, as opposed to 25% in 26% in November. Almost all of that comes out of the Republicans shifting more and more in favor of Israel, not the Democratic side. Just one final point with regard to two questions I want to go through, which is the settlement. So I ask a question about the Israeli settlements and what they want the U.S. to do about them, and that one we've been tracking. So in November, we had 58% of the public say they want the U.S. to do nothing or just limit its opposition to words. 37% said they want the U.S. To impose sanctions or take more serious action, so punitive action, 37%. If you look now, it's 39%. That's really statistically insignificant, so it's really roughly the same. But here's the interesting thing again. You know, if you break it down, Democrats and Republicans, Democrats increase a little more. So now it's 51% of Democrats who want to impose punitive measures against Israeli settlements. 73% of Republicans want to do nothing or limit opposition to words. And here's another interesting thing, which is when you look at, as you might expect, also millennials are sort of more supportive of taking punitive action than other groups. But here's the interesting story, too, about supporters of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. While there's no difference among them on the degree of where they want the U.S. to take sides, it's the same. On this issue, also there's not a huge difference within the margin of error, but it's interestingly even, 54% of Hillary Clinton supporters say they want the U.S. to take punitive action on settlements. This is not about pro-Israel being against Israel, specific to settlements. And 50% of Bernie Sanders supporters versus only 24% of Donald Trump supporters. And one final question where you will see the biggest difference between Hillary Clinton's supporters and Bernie Sanders supporters, and that is how much influence do you believe the Israeli government has on American politics and policies? And so what you have here is really not a big shift from last year. From last November. Look at this. I mean, basically, you have 18%, now 16% in May, saying too little influence. Too much influence goes up from 37 to 41% across the board. But then when you look at it by supporters of the candidates, look at the differences here. This is probably the biggest difference between the supporter of the two Democratic candidates. I don't know what to make of that. We have 48% of Hillary Clinton supporters say too much influence versus 44 who say about the right level of influence versus for Bernie Sanders, 57% say it's too much influence, 29% who say too little. It's really the only thing that we found on attitudes toward the Middle East where there's a difference between the candidates. And by the way, it's interesting because there are a couple of political scientists who have written recently a very interesting article for the Washington Post Monkey Cage arguing that Bernie Sanders supporters, by and large, are not any more liberal than Hillary Clinton's supporters. If you look at some of the key issues, we find evidence of that here with some very few exceptions. But I'll end with that and join the conversation. Thank you very much.
I'm going to sit on the end, actually. Well, folks, thanks very much. And we're just going to get my colleagues here mic'd up so that we can continue the conversation and then open it up to all of you in a few minutes. There was a lot in there, Bill, but I think if I had to come up with a single headline, it would be polarization. That we see significant differences between Republicans and Democrats, between Trump supporters and Clinton supporters, and Clinton and Sanders supporters seem very similar along most of these axes. And Shibley, you noted in your piece for Politico this morning the polarization just on the question that you began with, where we see this heartening response that actually. More favorable views of Islam and Muslims and a sense that Islam and the West are not in direct conflict with one another. But even on that, Bill, we see polarization. So I wonder if you can give us some thoughts on this polarized era.
Well, I wish I could deliver better news. It would be wonderful if we were moving back toward an era in which political differences ended at the water's edge,
when was that?
Well, when I was in high school, it was pretty close. You know, if you listen to the Nixon Kennedy debates, mm-hmm. which I was plenty old enough to do, I regret to inform you, you really couldn't. If there was a cold warrior, it was JFK, and. You know, the debates about the status of Kimoi and Matsu for the old timers in the audience. I mean, it was very fine-grained difference. So there was such a period in American history. It may have been aberrant, but it lasted for quite some time, and it was very significant. Those days are gone, and this survey, I think, puts a fine point on that. I went through the survey and just pulled out a few of the most significant instances of polarization. This is a different way of cutting the data and presenting them. So let me just spend a minute or two mm-hmm. going through it. When you ask Republicans, is your attitude towards the Muslim religion favorable? 24% say yes. When you put that question to Democrats, 64%. Say yes. So there's there's just a 40-point difference. And when you look at the election that we're actually having, 66% of Hillary Clinton's supporters have a favorable attitude towards the Muslim religion. And I'm astonished to report a figure as high as 16% for Donald Trump. That 16% obviously hasn't been paying too much attention or doesn't believe him. So that's a 50-point gap, 50 percentage points. I mean, the gaps don't get much bigger than that. And here's another example. The 55% of Republicans believe in the clash of civilizations thesis, that Islamic and Western religious and social traditions are incompatible with each other. The percentage for Democrats is 17%. I continue. But you're beginning to get the idea. When you look at Clinton supporters versus Trump supporters on that question, once again, you see about a 50-point gap. 13% believe in this incompatibility when you ask Hillary Clinton supporters. 62% when you ask Donald Trump supporters, a 49% gap. So all of this is to suggest that the election that we were actually going to have represents a greater degree of polarization between the two candidates and their supporters, if such a thing were imaginable, than even between the political parties that they represent. So it's polarization on steroids. And when it comes to the war in Iraq versus withdrawing from Iraq, polar opposites.
Almost mirror images.
You know, right? Which of the two is more important in the rise of ISIS? 34% of Republicans say going to war with Iraq as opposed to withdrawing precipitately from Iraq. 74% of Democrats, a 40-point gap. There are very significant differences on the issue of the four options towards the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian contest. Fully 39% of Republicans support what I regard as one of the two non-solutions. That is to say, outright annexation without the grant of equal citizenship to the people who've been annexed, or simply maintaining the occupation. You know, as you might imagine, the figure on the Democratic side is much lower. And again, when you look at Clinton supporters versus Trump supporters, those differences are even more pronounced. As Shibley pointed out, on the Jewishness versus democratic character of Israel, if you have to choose, what should be the role of the United States in mediating the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? 52% of Republicans say that the United States should lean toward Israel. 15% of Democrats take that view. A 37-point gap on something very, very fundamental. And the gap, when you look at Trump versus Clinton, is 50 percentage points. 55% lean towards Israel for Republicans, 5% for Clinton supporters. I've gone on. I have more to say on this, but I think you've gotten the point. Right, that this is, you know, these cleavages are remarkable even by the standards of domestic policy in the United States. These cleavages are more significant than you find, or larger than you find, on issues like abortion and same-sex marriage. It's big.
So
indeed, huge.
Going to follow up on
well,
that.
Well, yeah, so yeah. I want to ask you about this, Shibley, because this huge polarization. You know, and we've talked on this stage and many of your colleagues, Bill, on the FixGov blog and so on, about the way our information environment, our media environment shapes this polarization. People living in informational bubbles where their pre-existing views are reinforced. But, of course, we're in a campaign season right now, so all of those narratives are magnified. And maybe it's the campaign that's driving this greater polarization more than the polarization driving the candidates. And so I wonder, Shibley, you know, given this is one explanation you put forward in your Politico piece this morning on attitudes toward Islam, do you think we'll see Americans, those gaps narrow a bit after the election season's over? Will Americans revert to a mean even a little bit, or are we stuck here?
Well, let me break that down into two questions. One about the election season itself, which is important and polarizing, and then the trend, which Bill talked about. If you recall, in a poll I did 2 years ago, we started noticing that the gap was widening. In fact, I did a Washington Post piece called the widening partisan gap
on the Israeli-Palestinian
conflict. Yes. And Bill was there, and Bill said something that turned out to be right. And he said that if you look at these polls, the position of Republican politicians on issues related to the Middle East is very close to their constituents. But the positions of the Democratic politicians on some of those issues were far from their constituents. And I wrote a piece expecting that somebody was going to challenge that, like Bernie Sanders. I didn't mention Bernie Sanders. So we have been seeing this for some time. But what's interesting about this poll is that it's even widened further. And the results show, even from November, it has widened further. One reason it has widened further is because we're in the heat of a political season that's polarized, for sure. And so when I'm looking at the data and I'm saying, okay, we've had a really remarkable improvement in American public attitudes from November to now. It's like 7 months. And it's a short time to have measurable improvement at a time when people were expecting to go the other direction anyway. Well, it can't be that people suddenly had a complete reinterpretation of Islam and Muslims. That just doesn't happen. So a lot of it has to do with the fact that we are in the middle of a very polarized campaign where the issue of Islam and Muslim is one of the central issues of the debate. And it's like you taking side. If you take the narrative side that Muslims are the problem, you're taking Donald Trump's side. And so there's a countermeasure. So the rejection of that view is partly a rejection, is partly taken sides in the political debate, and the Islam and Muslim issue is somewhat of a side issue. So in that sense...
So people are saying, I don't like Trump, therefore I don't like what he says about Muslims, and I think the opposite.
And I think that explains the degree of change. But here's why I don't think that's only it. So, yes, it might go down after the campaign, and it's going to depend who's going to be the next president, because president plays a role in defining the narrative and shaping the narrative for sure. And I think because we're in the heat of the campaign now, and that has become a central issue, not only has Trump presented his case, but everybody else who didn't want him to win had an incentive in building the strongest case to counter him, including the President of the United States and the presumed Democratic candidate, and everybody else who wants to counter him is weighing in on behalf of Muslims and Islam in order to prevent him from winning that point. So, but yet, there are trends that show that maybe there's something else going on. Maybe not wouldn't explain the huge increase, but it would explain why we might be having incremental shifts. So one is that, we are obviously... Orlando and San Bernardino, horrific events. I mean, the shooting in Orlando was the worst shooting in American history. But we've been debating this issue since 9/11. This is not something about the connection between Islam and politics. We've been debating it for a decade and a half. And I think we've had a settling of views after a decade and a half. And people have developed more nuanced understanding, and that shows up even in the interpretation of the data, the interpretation of Orlando itself, as I suggested earlier. So that's one thing. The second thing is that even aside from this settling, I think, we are having a shift taking place in America demographically. Yes, it is, of course, a long party line, but it goes beyond party line. So we find that non-whites tend to be far more sympathetic with Muslims and Islam than whites. We find younger people to be far more sympathetic than, let's put it this way, less critical of Islam and Muslims than older people. We find that people who speak a language other than English, it doesn't matter what it is, in addition to English, have a far better view. People who have relatives overseas, outside the United States, even distant relatives, doesn't matter where, and mm-hmm. not from the Middle East, tend to have better views. People who use the internet and are communicating on the internet more frequently with people who are non-Americans, all are trending in the other direction, meaning somewhat more favorable views of Islam and Muslims. And that's where America is headed. The millennials, it's not just the millennials. The millennials are the globally connected millennials.
are the new cosmopolitan millennials. So it's not just a generational issue, but it's a generational issue connected to a global connection. And in that sense, I think there is a trend that's pushing in the other direction, just as the negative views may have settled or bottomed out after a decade and a half of 9/11.
Great, thank you. So there are some political drivers, but there are broader demographic shifts in the American population that are pushing the averages in a particular direction. I want to come back to the millennials, and Bill, you had a great event this morning talking about millennials and the changing demographics of America, so please feel free to pipe up on that. But I want to just spend a minute on the public's interpretations of the Orlando attacks. And it seemed to me, Bill, you know, I'd love your thoughts on this. Is this actually one place where there is a single American story or a single American view that there, you know, this is driven by hatred of the LGBT community, that ISIS ideology did play a role, but it wasn't ISIS itself, and that gun control would help stop things like this? These seem to be things where there was a broader consensus. Were there other areas of consensus?
Oh, Lord.
In other words, you're going to burst my balloon right now, aren't you?
I'm not going to burst your balloon. But I don't want to drill down too far into the data. There were significant differences, particularly as you might imagine in the area of gun legislation, and there were also some very remarkable differences in, you know, in the interpretation of the event. Let me give you one. First of all, African Americans as a group are by far the most sympathetic group to Muslims in the entire U.S. population. When I say by far, let me illustrate what I mean. When Shibley in May, you know, asked, "What's your attitude about each of the following?" White Americans report 35% of white Americans said that they had a favorable attitude towards the Muslim religion, and the remainder, close to 65%, had an unfavorable view. For African Americans, 64% had a favorable view, an almost 40-point gap.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And by the way, this was not a simple whites versus non-whites, because when you put the same question to Latinos, they were almost evenly split.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 51% had a favorable view, 49% an unfavorable view. So this is a distinctive characteristic of African Americans. Now, yes, Latinos were more sympathetic to Muslims than whites, but if you create a spectrum with whites on one end and African Americans at the other, the Latinos are right in the middle. And so, by the way, are Asian Americans. And now, talk about two different views of reality. 33% of Americans, 33% of Americans said that radical Islamist ideology is at least contributory to Mateen's overall motive for acting. 40% of whites believe that. You know what the number is for African Americans? 3%. Okay, so once again, you know, I don't want to pop your balloon, but I'm going to squeeze it a little bit. I mean, there are some really significant differences here that we have to pay attention to. And by the way, these go to matters of fact. See, Shibley, Shibley pointed out that it's very important to, you know, to probe respondents' grasp of certain basic facts. 66% of Americans overall believe that Omar Mateen was born and raised in America. That figure is 36% for African Americans. So there is a way in which one's priors shape one's beliefs about certain basic facts of the case and can sometimes distort them. So these are, this is a big deal. And, you know, and the African-American white split is not trivial in the country, and it's not even trivial within the Democratic Party. And these are some of the ways in which it's going to play out in attitudes towards Islam.
Did you see anything in this data, Bill, that suggests to you that there are issues of broader agreement or, dare we say, even consensus?
Look, I would say that there was something close to a consensus, although I'm using the word consensus very loosely here, on a pretty fundamental question. And that is, do we share enough as human beings, just simply as human beings, that there is the possibility of reaching common ground across these cultural and religious differences?
A phrase we're hearing a lot this past week.
And I think that, you know, and I think the American answer to that is yes. And that's good news. We have something to work with. It's also the case that there is a very solid American majority, you know, across all sorts of lines, on the question of what the top priorities of American foreign policy should be. And this I think is also quite revealing. Shibley and company tested 12 items. Okay, and let's just take the 1 to 10 in importance scale. The top four all involved questions that directly affect the American people. You know, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, trade, and immigration. The middle tier were the four big-ticket countries who worry us, Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. And bringing up the rear were the four Middle Eastern questions. So it's not just the President of the United States who'd like to give the Middle East a little bit less emphasis in the conduct of American foreign policy. It's pretty clearly the American people as well. And it would be going too far to say that the American people want to wash their hands of the Middle East. They don't. But clearly, they're, if I can apply a gloss to these numbers, they are quite tired of the prominence that the Middle East has played in American foreign policy over the past 15 years. And would like to see it, so to speak, right-sized in the conduct of our foreign policy.
Okay, so Shibley, I want to ask you to respond a bit to that last point of Bill's, which, you know, the data supports, but it's also a challenge, I think, to those of us who would make the argument that the Middle East still is important to America's global interests and to security, and that there are links between the terrorist threat and these other Middle Eastern policy issues. You've been doing polling on Middle East policy issues and American attitudes for a while now, and you've also done the reverse, attitudes in the region toward the U.S. and what they want the U.S. to do. Is there common ground?
That's a great question. That's a great question. Of course, you know, when it comes to that, I mean, when I often, as you know, go to the Middle East on a regular basis and talk to people who think that they're the biggest story in the world. And why are you doing this to us? And I say, well, you're not. It's hard to tell people you're not top priority for the administration. But yes, no, I think a lot of people don't get it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't get it. They think more important than they are more important to American priorities, and they really don't get it. That it's the fact that they're not in the top three of America's priorities means that America is not going to put the kind of energy that might be required to address their issues, even if one. But I want to say two things related to the priorities. Number one is that I agree with Bill. That's why I love always to hear him, because he adds a lot of value to this issue. But I agree with the fact that the polarization is deep, and it's just, it's paradigmatic. It's not just issue specific. Issues are actually the side story, because it's a worldview that is profoundly different. But yet, if you put aside the divide and you look at the trajectory of America, you're still having this shift at the national level that is actually more heartening than not. So yes, we are having
more and more divide, but still there is the overall outcome of the national
if you look at it
shift,
in aggregate.
If you look at it in aggregate, we are moving, and the results are in some ways far surprisingly shifting in a different direction than what one might expect. But on the Middle East priorities, yes, if you look at those issues and how they rank from 1 to 10, just don't forget that two of the top four are ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
Right.
Okay. So, all right. So ISIS and Al-Qaeda, yes, people don't tie them. They don't know what they mean. We haven't probed, what do you want to do about fighting ISIS? What do you want to do about fighting Al-Qaeda? How can you do it without building alliances with the regional powers? What does it mean for, you know, our, is the Arab-Israeli issue here involved? Is the relationship with Saudi Arabia involved? Is the, all of that stuff, of course, isn't there. So in real policy terms, if I'm a politician and I'm dealing with the priorities for the next administration, I want to see what the public is wants us to deal with. Immigration and trade obviously are up there, but I would say the biggest cluster is fighting ISIS and Al Qaeda, and you can't take that out of the Middle East. So yes, the public at some level is very uncomfortable, doesn't want to get into the detail, don't want to hear so much about Egypt and Saudi Arabia, or even Israel, Palestine, and not even Iran, and yet at the same time, they're obsessed with some core issues that takes them back to the Middle East.
So you're saying that if a president said, look, folks, in order to fight terrorism effectively, we have to do all this other stuff in the Middle East, that's a colorable argument with the public.
Yeah.
It is, but I think, continuing my role as skunk at the garden party.
Although I will note that you predicted the shift in American public opinion on putting troops back into Iraq as a result of the terrorist threat. So
that's true, but the American people, I think, if you probe the deep emotion, they want a painless solution to the terrorism problem. Okay, what they desperately want to hear is that there is a solution that does not involve a third large commitment of U.S. resources and especially ground forces. Mm-hmm. The American people will tolerate drones for the next 100 years. They will tolerate, in effect, an offshore campaign, whether it's naval or Air Force. I think that they will have a very hard time, even if a president makes a compelling, rational case that you can't deal with Al-Qaeda without doing a lot more in Mesopotamia, broadly construed, than we've been willing to do up to now, and particularly in Syria. Even if that's a compelling policy case, I think the next president is going to have a hard time selling that case to the American people.
And I agree with that. And I agree with that, and other polls have indicated that's true.
Okay, and of course, you note that on a day when President Obama announced several hundred more troops being sent to Iraq to support the Iraqi army in its quest to take back Mosul. And we've already got special operators on the ground in Syria and a total of something north of 6,000 troops operating back in Mesopotamia. And an announcement also within the last week that the U.S. forces in Afghanistan would remain at a higher level than anticipated. So is this already kind of pushing the envelope of what the American public are willing to countenance?
Well, it would, especially if there are casualties, and then it comes back with a radar screen. But right now, I think, because these don't seem like huge numbers and they're basically invisible, I think people are sticking with their candidates and the heat of the campaign and who's going to fight against that in this environment. Because if it's coming from the Democratic president and the Democratic candidate is going to support them and the Republicans are not really going to take issue from the left, I think. But as the new president-elect takes office and things can get out of hand, could become a big problem for the next president.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the classic problem with escalation, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Okay, I'm going to open it up to all of you. We have limited time and a lot of folks in the room, and I see a number of hands up already, so I'm going to ask you, in fact, I'm going to demand of you that you be disciplined. Number one, wait for the microphone. Number two, please identify yourself. And number three, one, if you could, short, sharp question. We'll get to as many of you as we can, and we'll start right there on the aisle. Yes. Yep.
Hi, I'm Masara Makati with the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. This is something that a lot of people have opinions on. I just wanted to hear yours. After 9/11, favorability of Muslims and Islam increased, same after the Charlie Hebdo attacks. I want to say even after the Boston Marathon bombings. So what's your opinion on why this happens? Because a lot of people would expect the opposite, and especially, like you said, in the context of the campaign.
Well, I've actually written about this. I addressed that a little bit in the political piece that I have today, and I wrote another piece for Brookings last December. So I invite you to review a little bit more of how these trends have taken place. Actually, one of the things that happened after 9/11 is the interesting thing is that for quite a while, American views of Islam as a religion didn't really get worse. They remained relatively positive. Certainly, the first one done by ABC News, I think, in 2 months after was more favorable than unfavorable, and several other polls right after. I think things didn't really start getting worse till the war in Afghanistan and then Iraq that changed the paradigm. And my own view, at least it's an interpretation, it's debatable. My own view is that we had an intense season of a lot of violence that was highly charged, painful to America, particularly the Iraq War. We had a paradigm here that favored the clash of civilization interpretation. And I think the highest level I have recorded of negative views of Islam by the American public was originally in 2011, which was 61%. And that remained relatively, I can't tell exactly at every point, but measured it again in November last year, it was still 61%. So we didn't really have, I think it leveled off at that point. And I think now we have the spike because of what I suggested earlier. But I don't think it's been static. It's definitely been dynamic.
Okay, thank you. We'll take a question right over here. And maybe we'll take a couple together if that's okay with you folks. Good.
Thanks very much, Shibley, as always. Gert Mitchell from the Mitchell Report. And I want to come back to what I think was said at the outset, which is that the Middle East isn't as important in the minds of American people and foreign policy issues. And yet, as you've just pointed out, that one could argue that that when you have ISIS and Al-Qaeda among the top four, it seems to me those are sort of both proxies for the Middle East, and they might have been even more proxies if you had said ISIS / Syria or Al-Qaeda / Iraq, et cetera. Having said that, the question that I have, and this goes to Bill's point about there's very little popular support for a third campaign being waged in that region. As interesting as this listing is, and as telling as it is in some respects, in the final analysis, isn't it really the case that, as Prime Minister McMillan said many years ago, that what drives policy decisions is events, dear boy, events, and that if there's another ISIS
right.
or Al-Qaeda-related thing, we can say about that chart, interesting but not relevant. And that's a question, actually.
Right. And this has actually been a question throughout this political season,
right.
is what would be the impact of a terrorist attack on on a campaign. You did the before and afters around Orlando. You know, it certainly wasn't your intention going in, but you had the opportunity to do that. So do you see any evidence to support Gary's hypothesis that it's an attack that matters?
Well, let's put it this way. Obviously, American priorities can shift depending on events that are outside of America's control. That's always the case. You know, whether it's terrorism or something else happening, where the U.S. is going to have to react in a way that is unexpected. But it is not true, in my own opinion, and never has been true, in my own opinion, that because X happens, then Y is predictable in the way the U.S. reacts to it. So the real question isn't whether there's going to be a big terrorist attack, we know they happen, or there's going to be a big crisis, we know it's happened. It's going to be how the U.S. is going to react to it. And I don't buy the argument, I never did, that 9/11 explains the Iraq War. I never bought that. That was a war of choice. That was a choice to use 9/11 to justify an Iraq war. And I don't buy the argument that any president would have taken the U.S. toward an Iraq war just because of 9/11. So therefore, I think what we're talking about here, about where the public is, whether they've settled, whether they have paradigmatic view of the world, what the worldview is, matters a lot. And so I don't, I think therefore, it's critical to understand where the public is after all these years of debate. And it's also critical who is the commander-in-chief, because the commander-in-chief in times of crisis, we all know this is not new in American politics, she or he has the opportunity to define how the public reacts, how the nation reacts by rallying the public behind them. So it's not predictable how the U.S. will react to it, even if you know something like that is likely to happen.
Hmm. I guess I would just add, there are attacks and attacks. Okay, the paradigm after 9/11 was attacks in effect from abroad by foreign nationals. The emerging new paradigm is one of self-radicalization on the part of people, many of whom were born here and grew up here. And so what you think the appropriate response is depends very much on how you interpret the source of the attack. So if we have a third and then a fourth self-radicalization incident, will the default position of the American people be we have to go full bore into Syria, or will it be much more a domestic security reaction, and which could involve some serious abridgment of what we take to be, in normal circumstances, civil liberties? And so, as I say, it really depends.
Thank you. Okay, Ariel, you have a microphone in the back too, right? Okay, so we're going to take some questions from the back and make you run back and forth. Starting on this side, the gentleman in the blue jacket.
Thank you. My name is Martin. I am a research assistant at SAIS. This was a very interesting discussion, and I must say that one kind of reading that comes to my mind is Morris Fiorina's culture war, The Myth of a Polarized America. So I don't want to take much time to actually, go over his argument, but I would think that, you probably would know some of his arguments. And it's just free feel to ignore my question if you don't.
Does this data support the culture war argument?
But no, I would really appreciate to just, if you can just engage with, what Fiorina might potentially kind of say in, if he would actually disagree with actually your argument that actually there is more and more polarization in the U.S. And if he would actually disagree, how would you actually kind of counter disagree with him? I mean, I would appreciate that.
All right. That would be a very interesting dialogue. Unfortunately, he's not in the room.
Right.
But we'll do our best.
Yes,
because
please.
I've engaged with his work for a decade now. And to put it simply, I think he's wrong. And I think these data are one further indication of why I think he's wrong.
And so I see no conflict whatsoever between this report and what I believe to be the truth of the matter more generally.
Okay, thank you. Let's now flip over to the other side in the back. Saeed in the tan jacket.
And thank you. My name is Saeed Erica.
Sorry, Saeed, when you're done, just pass the mic to the gentleman right in front of you. We'll take you, both your questions together.
Thank you. My name is Saeed Erica. I'm a Palestinian journalist. On the Palestinian-Israeli issue, how do you reconcile the fact that the poll shows virtually no difference between Sanders supporters and Clinton supporters? Yet, in the drafting of the platform and the drafting committee, there was a huge difference. I mean, there was a big split between the two, with the Sanders camp insisting on adding an end to occupation and so on, if you can. Thank you.
Okay, and?
Hi, my name is Diego. I'm an intern at the Climate Institute. My question is regarding the possible motivations for Omar Martin's actions. I was wondering if there was a question about racism or Hispanophobia, because I think that can play just as important role as homophobia in this case. I don't think it's a coincidence that all of these victims were Latinx people. And even if Orlando is predominantly Latinx community, that does not, I still don't think that Hispanophobia is out of the conversation. So I would like to hear more about why people are not acknowledging that as a possibility, or if that showed up in your survey at all. Thank you.
Thank you. It's certainly an element that hasn't been discussed as much in the public conversation around these attacks, and I don't know what the crosstabs show, Shibley, but maybe there's some data on differential views on that as well. So you want to kick us off?
I mean, first on the Arab-Israeli issue, I have an interpretation. There's a whole debate, of course, on this. It's complicated and needs further studies. I need to study it a little bit more. I'm actually doing an article on it, so I'll be probing more into the data to see what the differences are. But I'm persuaded, actually, that at the core, the differences within the Democratic Party on the matter of Israel-Palestine isn't as big as it looks in principle. When you look at, for example, what Sanders proposes in terms of out two-state solution, et cetera, they're very similar. And the differences are more embracing a candidate you think would win better. It's not, people are not choosing the candidate based on whether they're going to be good for Palestine or for Israel. Let's keep that in mind. So when they're choosing Sanders and they're choosing Clinton, they're choosing him for other reasons. This is a marginal issue for the American public. So it's not a surprise to me that Democrats, as we see across the board, I don't want to say unified, completely unified, but very close across the board. And the biggest puzzle to me is not the differences between Sanders and Hillary Clinton but the fact that the public seems to be more angry with Israeli policy than the politicians are. That has been the case, and particularly on settlements. Settlements really get the public, and we've seen that before, but particularly gets Democrats. Now, with that, I also want to add something that I'm probing. I've been writing on what I call cosmopolitanism, and I tie the millennial generation to what I call a cosmopolitan identity, meaning people who are more egalitarian, better connected globally. They're more for social justice. Human rights plays an important role. We see all kinds of attitudes projected out of that generation, connected to globalization perhaps, but also connected maybe to youth. I mean, it's hard to know which is which, but it's there. And the Arab-Israeli conflict, while it's not a priority for that generation or any generation in America, frankly, it is still a very important prototype on a whole set of issues of human rights, justice for a lot of the millennials. And that's one reason I think why it became much more galvanizing to some of the supporters of Sanders, who were particularly among the young. And we see when you look at it, when you look at the divide by age, how the
the younger Democrats were far more angry on this issue. Now, with the second question on homophobia, I didn't fully understand it. He says, why is it that we're not being...
The question is, did you probe at all whether racism against Latinos, played a role in these attacks, or whether the American public sees this at all through that lens?
No, that's an interesting question. I did not probe into it. I did not look into it, and I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know if you had any thoughts on it, but I haven't really reflected on that at all.
It's an interesting... I want to go back to the point about the millennials and this idea of a more cosmopolitan rising generation, because we see in a lot of the questions that millennials are outliers on the left, mm-hmm. on a lot of answers. And one way of thinking about it is, you know, getting back to your event this morning, Bill, that America is changing. Mm-hmm. We're going to be a majority-minority society. And so millennials representing that come to the political table with a different set of attitudes. Another hypothesis is that these are young people, and as they get older, they'll be less progressive. So your thoughts on that, Bill?
Well, this morning, you know, I requested and fortunately received in the nick of time the so-called age crosstabs. And there's no question about the fact that there are generational differences, particularly between the millennials and everyone else. Let me just illustrate, attitudes towards Muslim people. 55 and older, about 51% had favorable views. For 18 to 34, 67%, a 16-point gap. And you know, when it came to religion, an 18-point gap in favor of more Muslim religion, more favorable views among young people. They were substantially less likely to see an incompatibility between Islam and the West. Over and over mm-hmm. again, you saw evidence of the sorts of things that Shibley was talking about. Now, if you assume that these attitudes persist and are increasingly imported into the mainstream of American politics as millennials become ever larger in the electorate, as they become full adults, whenever that is. My son is almost 32, so I'll keep you posted. I think that over time, all other things being equal, you could expect some significant shifts in these areas. But it will require a lot of patience, and I'm not sure I will live to see it reach fruition.
Okay. I'm afraid we're out of time. I know there were a lot of you we weren't able to get to today. I want to encourage you to take a look at the data. The full results are posted on the Sadat website at the University of Maryland. And engage with us on Twitter, on Facebook. We look forward to continuing this conversation. And this is an issue we will be continuing to track as Shibley does his polling in the coming months and years. So thanks.